Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and I'm looking for a book about monsters to help me or my friends Ian and Joe, two ghoulish English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And today, Nick, I have a story for you about the man of twists and turns himself. Wow. I'm, of course, talking about Odysseus from the famous monster-laden book, Tale, Tome, The Odyssey.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book about monsters, I think you should read the straightforward and eminently readable English poem Beowulf about Beowulf.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Joe, is your book a book or is it a poem?
It is an epic poem, the epicest of all poems. It is in book form, though. It takes place in 24 different
on paper
chapters, you might call it. You might also call them like verses. My book's a poem in book form.
Did you both bring poems?
We did.
This is poetry week.
Trapped.
I kind of thought we should talk about this because
I think you guys are the real monsters.
I feel like there should be some sort of sound effect that plays when we bring a poem. Like we found out
that's
poetry
a great
week.
Idea,
we should
Joe.
Get like ding 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 ding.
Yeah, that's what every podcast needs is more sound effects. Cool sound effects.
I'm curious, Nick, why you hate poetry? Okay. All right. So check it out. We have done one episode before where I brought a poem and my book lost for a variety of legitimate reasons. But I think a lot of people don't like poetry. And I may be correct in grouping you in that group, Nick. So I'm wondering, like, is that fair to say, Nick, do you like poetry?
I do not go in the woods and read poetry or curl up in a comfy chair with a cup of coffee and read poetry.
I wonder who does. Like, I wonder that. Like, when I was in school and there would be like these MFA students that were majoring in poetry, right? They're getting their MFA with a focus on poetry. I always just thought that's a bold move.
Well, it's like there's some alcohols that you like really have to train your palate to enjoy.
it's no, like when like, you have beer for the first yeah. time.
Well, kind of, honestly.
You gotta really grow to love it.
Yeah, and beer, thank God, happens pretty fast. Like you get, most people get over that hump pretty quickly. I think poetry might be kind of like a sour. I know people who love sour beers.
Ooh, I love sours. Hey, Ian, if I love sours, will I also love poetry?
Well, I think maybe. Or at least you have the sort of personality.
I don't think I have the patience for poetry.
I always kind of like teaching a poem, right? And there's this big divide between those two things, because when you teach a poem, you of course have this room to luxuriate, right? You have this room to explore things and think about it more deeply than you ever would
curled up with
a sour.
Yeah, that's true.
Guys, so this is our first, we're doing a bit of a theme within a theme.
We're doing a theme. Welcome to the Mocking Nick's Intonations Hour.
I brought my two teachers here to tell me about their favorite books. Guys, so this month we're doing back to school. Sharpen your pencils and get out your notebooks. We're getting back to school.
Yay. Is this where we're supposed to say, like, yeah, go team?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Go team.
Joe?
Yes, I'm ready.
Say go team, you fucking idiot. Are you even listening?
Go team.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, guys. It was good feedback. Way to be in the moment. So yeah, we're if you didn't like it in high school, you might still not like it. But this month, we are going back to some of the books that Joe and Ian are teaching, and we're just coming up with themes for each one of the weeks. So this week is monsters, and you guys brought poems. So good work.
Thank you. I appreciate that positive reinforcement.
Do we have to change the intro to this show? You know, I'm looking for a book / poem / you know, short story.
No, it's a book length poem. It's a book length yeah. poem.
They're books.
They're books. They're on paper. Or can
here? Listen to this. Listen to this.
It's good.
Pretty good.
Some papers shuffling.
What was that, Ian? Was that a deck of cards?
Yeah, I'm playing some solitaire. I'm so brilliant that I have to keep my hands and my mind occupied while I do this podcast. Otherwise, just overwhelm you with my intelligence.
You're like a book magician.
I'm like David Blaine for books. Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. David Blaine, if you're listening, that may have sounded a bit disrespectful. it was, I think. I'm sorry about that. It was a bit disrespectful, and I apologize.
I have no doubt that David Blaine is listening, so let's all apologize.
Maybe, to be honest, you should probably begin every episode with an apology to David Blaine, like a blanket apology.
I feel like David Blaine would be a powerful enemy, right? Like, I don't think you need a sorcerer on the other side of the fence.
I think there is a deep misunderstanding about what David Blaine is, Joe.
You keep waking up with quarters in your ear.
Just rabbits.
David,
just
stop
everywhere.
It. I'm sorry. I said I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, David Blaine. I'm so sorry. I'm just imagining Joe's morning routine, just kind of stumbling around his house. Oh, he opens up his closet and doves come out.
He opens the cabinet in the bathroom, and David Blaine, tiny David Blaine, is sitting there grinning at him.
Wordlessly grinning.
Like an Indian in the cupboard reference. What was that?
Oh, we should bring Indian in the cupboard.
I don't know what this is. What is this?
It's a really racist movie that might have been a book.
It's a book that was really big, I feel like, in my childhood. I think I read it probably third or fourth grade, and it's about a boy who has a tiny cupboard in which he can put in his toys. And when he puts his toys in that
Woody?
Cupboard, they come to life.
Oh, yeah, it's Toy Story. Like,
it's Toy Story before Toy Story.
Huh.
Or but actually, racist.
Well, it's Toy Story for racists.
Listen, folks. Are you a racist? Did you want to like Toy Story, but it was not racist enough for you? Good news.
Was that Randy Newman? Was that impression?
No.
You got a racist in me.
I don't even know what that is.
You know. I think we should just start announcing whether these books are canceled. Just a reoccurring question. Is this book canceled? Is this book not canceled?
It's not.
Hey, spoilers, Indian in the cupboard. That might be canceled.
It is over.
Guys, let's do our 30-second plots here. Joe, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. All right. The Odyssey is about Odysseus, who is the hero of the Trojan War, and his long and winding journey back to Ithaca. Along the way, he's faced with all manner of trials and outwits, overpowers, or outlucks, with a bit of divine intervention, every obstacle that comes his way. At least for himself, his men all perish. It's a book about love. It's a book about adventure. But all of the best parts in this book, Nick, are about monsters. The guy's so cool, he just gets one name. You've heard of Beyonce. You've heard of Madonna. Let me introduce you to Homer.
Would you say Homer is precisely the same as Beyonce and Madonna and Beck and Pink?
Oh, there's so many, aren't they? I would say Homer is the Beyonce of his day.
That's fabulous. Good. I like that.
Fabulous. Like that.
Wait, is Beyonce blind?
Was Homer blind?
Also, Homer. I stole that. I stole that piece of trivia from you.
No,
Joe,
Ian, anything else you want to tell you about my book? You son of a bitch.
You're ruining my presentation.
Let me just cross out my first bullet point.
I'll be honest. I mentally have a very, very difficult time navigating all of this Greek literature, who wrote it, and creating separation between all of it. Is he Greek?
Yeah, he's Greek.
And by the way, I do say this as a Greek person.
Yeah, Nick. Yeah, so
you're
allowed
talk all the trash you want, Nick.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, let's save that then. Ian, let's save that trash. Ian, are you ready?
So
it's
ready.
Very important that you're ready. How many times did you practice your 30 seconds?
Only like Go. 40. If you like feats of superhuman strength, a classic tale of good versus evil, surprisingly readable poetry, boasts about long swims, grody man-eating monsters, magic swords, and a big old dragon battle, you should read Beowulf by Anonymous. We don't know who wrote it.
Wait, what?
We don't know who wrote this.
Was it Homer? Was it Beyonce?
It probably
That's time!
Was time-traveling Beyonce. Like,
I get why people really like her.
You do or don't?
I do.
Don't get us canceled. Do not get us canceled.
No, you can't talk shit about Beyonce. No.
No.
She's pretty likable. And she can time travel.
She can. It's true.
I think all the Illuminati can time travel.
Go on.
That's not sustainable.
Please don't stop there.
What you got?
Well, No, I don't really have anything.
No, he's got nothing.
It just seemed like, why?
I just dropped the Illuminati can time travel with no follow-up.
Joe legitimately considered like walking us through that, and he was like, nope.
No, they're listening. I'm sorry. I need to move on.
Wait, is David Blaine part of the Illuminati?
Hold on. There's only one way to find out.
taking every excuse not to talk about Beowulf and the Odyssey, aren't we?
I would like some clarification. Actually, you know what? No, I'd like to figure out. I want to hear more about Beyonce and Beowulf. So, Ian, please clear things up for me.
I'll clear it all up. So, it started in the year 2003. Beyonce was kind of moving towards the height of her power, and she was exploring a cave, and she happened across a glowing green artifact. And upon grasping it, she was flung backwards about 1,400 years in time, and she wrote the book, Beowulf. And that's the entirety of my case, and I'm sticking to it.
Was that just her or all of Destiny's Child?
Well, this is actually, it's kind of sad.
Did they ghostwrite this?
So, you know, Destiny's Child ended up kind of going their separate ways. And the reason was in part because they all wanted to grasp the glowing green artifact at the same time. But Beyonce sort of like said, I want to be the one to do this. And then before they came to a decision, she just reached out her hand and grabbed it. So she really kind of acted on her own. And then obviously now she can time travel, but also at the same time, you know, her band, her rock and roll group, Destiny's Child, was broken up. So
how long ago was Beowulf?
Well, so this is a really, really weird thing. Beowulf is
Ian, what the fuck is this? How do we not know who wrote it? How is it an iconic piece of literature that we don't know who wrote?
We don't actually know where the manuscript came from. So I'm going to talk just a tiny bit, kind of fill you guys in and our legions of litheads in on sort of manuscript culture, because this is important to understanding this book. Back before printing, the only way that texts could be transmitted was handwriting. So you would have parchment, or earlier than parchment, you would use papyrus, and you would use ink and a pen, and one person would write out the whole text. So these books, for a variety of reasons, these manuscript books were very valuable, and because they took a lot of work, they took a lot of time, and they were expensive. The materials were expensive too. And
tunnel, I imagine, was a huge factor.
Yes. Like the thought of writing the 3,000 lines of Beowulf out by hand is just horrifying to me. Miserable. I don't know how these guys did it, how these scribes did it. But
hey, Ian, I have a very simple question for you.
Yep. Yep.
Do we know who wrote this?
No.
You can't say for sure it wasn't Beyonce, can you?
I mean, no, we cannot say. I cannot definitively rule out Beyonce as a potential author.
Done.
So I say we don't know. We kind of don't know who wrote it. We don't know who came up with the story. We don't know who kind of made the poetry. We do know some things about the people who wrote it down. So the only manuscript which survives, there's only one manuscript of this incredibly important document. The only manuscript which survives dates back to a period between 925 AD and 10, or sorry, 975 AD and 1025 AD. So kind of this 50-year period. And we know this based on like the way that they were using language in the manuscript, which survives. There are two scribes we know based on studying the handwriting of the manuscript. Two scribes collaborated on this. And the first scribe was being very careful, very thorough, kind of making sure everything, dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. And the second, he left off mid-sentence around line 1900. And then the second scribe comes in and he's super sloppy. He's just kind of dashing it off and he doesn't seem to care about getting the text right. So we have an idea
dotting his T's or crossing his I think his
eyes. He's probably crossing his I's and dotting his T's, which, as we all know, is just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, that's not the way to do it.
This also feels kind of like a metaphor for teaching, right? Like I can just imagine.
maybe especially teaching last year, where halfway through we were like, oh man.
Changing horses. Like, okay, mainstream. Student, now you do it.
So this, are you saying this is like telephone? Somebody's like,
well, this is
I'll
the
do
thing.
Halvesies.
Telephone in more ways than one. So there is this text which is written down, but the text is a lot older than the story is a lot older than the manuscript. So the manuscript was written down in around the turn of the first millennium, so between 975 and 1025. But we believe the text is at least 200, possibly 300 years older than that. So it may have been like created around 650 AD or 700, somewhere in there. So it would have been made up by a poet, by a storyteller. The Old English called them scops. It was made up by a scop. And the scop would tell it, he would sing it, or he would recite it as entertainment because they didn't have HBO Go. And then somebody else, like when this scop got old and he was too old to kind of do his thing anymore, he would teach all of his stories to somebody else and they would pick up the tradition. And this is what's called the oral tradition, where stories are preserved not by writing them down, but by memory. And then passing them on, teaching them to other people. So
Nick, it is essentially a big multi-generational game of telephone.
Absolutely. And one of the most fascinating things is that we can see, you know, like when you play the game of telephone, as I'm sure you guys do on a daily basis, you may be able to kind of like, once you get to the end, kind of deduce sort of where things went wrong. Kind of figure out what the original message may have been. Looking at the story of Beowulf, there is a suggestion that the original story came from a pre-Christian England. So a lot of the story has kind of Christian elements. So Beowulf is constantly saying, praise God for giving me all this strength. And boy, isn't God great and all this. And there are a lot of references to like the Christian Bible. But there are also kind of leftover elements from a pre-Christian time, which suggests that this was more like a folktale where it was just a bunch of pagans fighting each other and monsters. And then as it kind of got telephoned through the centuries, the Christian influence kind of began to seep in and people started saying, well, I know the story says that he defeats Grendel by his strength of arm, but I'm going to say he defeats him by the strength of arm and God's help. And so we can kind of track based on the shape of the story where things started to change.
Hey, Ian, do you have like a source for this analysis? Because it seems like I bet this is well researched.
Yeah, it's crazy. This book, this poem has been studied in a scholarly way for about 500 years. So there's a lot of which I think when we get to Joe's book, that's small potatoes compared to this. but like for a piece of English literature, that's a lot. And so there's this huge body of antiquarians, like people back in the time that we think of as the old days. So people back in Shakespeare's time were already studying this book as a piece of ancient literature, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. Related to this, one of the things we do with manuscripts is we track how, like, who owned it, because then we can kind of like get a sense of, you know, where did it travel and how much did it sell for, and what kind of people were owning it. Was it primarily like common folk or noblemen or scholars? The crazy thing about this text, this single manuscript, is that there is a 500-year gap in its ownership history. So we don't know where it was between the time it was created and the mid-1500s. It's this huge period of time where nobody knows where this thing was. There are no records of ownership. We can't like deductive detective trace it back. It was just somewhere.
Just sitting, on Beyonce's shelf.
Yeah.
I think that's what she was in Destiny's Child.
Yeah, she took it back to maybe taunt Destiny's Child with, like, look what I did. No doubt. I'm breaking off from you guys. I'm going to have a solo career. And they knew it was over at that point.
How many more Beyonce jokes are we going to make?
Oh, so
we're probably.
I think like maybe one or two more tops.
I don't think so. I got bad news. I prepared a lot of Beyonce jokes.
Like half my notes are just Beyonce references.
Guys, I need the Beyonce stuff. I got one more interesting fact about this manuscript, which is probably my favorite fact about it. Can I tell you guys?
Yeah,
I would fucking love that.
Okay, great. Okay, so this guy, this collector owned the only manuscript of Beowulf. And there may have been others that kind of like got destroyed, fire, whatever, throughout. This is it. And by this time, we're pretty sure, like the antiquary and the book trade was pretty sure this is it. This is our only manuscript. It was housed in a library in Westminster, England, in Ashburnham House. And this library caught on fire. And shit. When a library catches on fire, especially in the 1700s, that's a problem. They didn't have like sprinkler systems or fire extinguishers. So what do? You have this library. It's too big. There's too many books in here to kind of save. So one guy grabbed the one of the original copies of the Greek New Testament from the 400s AD, and he carried that under his arm and he jumped out the second story window. So that one got saved. Then somebody saw the Beowulf manuscript.
Was he
said,
okay?
I think he broke his ankles. The manuscript is fine.
Survived.
I think he broke his ankles, but he's probably okay. And okay, you know, yeah, he saved the manuscript.
And he's still around.
Somebody saw the Beowulf manuscript, and they're like, "That's gonna get burned. We can't let that get burned." So what do? Well, they didn't have time to like carry it out, so they just threw it through a window.
Yeah, it's a good call.
They just tossed it. They tossed it out the window, and not before it had gotten a little bit scorched. So when you look at the pictures of the Beowulf manuscript online, like digital facsimiles, you can see the scarring, the scorching where the fire was getting to it.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah, literally pulled from fire.
Plucked from the flames.
Yes.
So, Ian, what's this book about?
It's like straightforward. That's my thing. Okay, so like whenever I don't want to attack Joe's book too hard, but I will say whenever I read the Odyssey, I get a little bit lost because there's so many layers of like storytelling and like who's talking now, and it gets kind of confusing. This book is straightforward. So Beowulf's job is fighting monsters. So in the land of the Spear Danes, a monster is stalking the mead hall of King Hrothgar.
God, I'm already done. That's all
you need.
Jesus. Okay. It's a lot of that, isn't it?
This king, I'll dial back the names because the names are kind of confusing. Okay. This king is not able to fight this monster because this monster cannot be hurt with swords or spears or other weapons. It's too strong for normal people to kill. And the monster's name is Grendel.
Ooh, he can only be hurt through what can hurt him? Is it ridicule or feelings?
he's vulnerable. He's vulnerable to psychic damage. So he's like kind of positioned as this supernatural, also super strong. He's got these like scales on his arms. He's very powerful. He's extremely strong. He eats people, and you can't stab him. He's too fast and he's too strong, and his skin is too strong. So
would you guys like to know the difference between a Grendel and a Taint?
I don't know. Grendel.
Okay, I'll just X out here.
Okay, so Grendel is like wrecking shop. He's wrecking hall. Fortunately, at this point, Beowulf, who is a preternaturally strong warrior who is from England, shows up and he says, "I'm here to fight this monster." And so he does so not by chopping at the monster with swords and spears, but rather by pitting his own strength against the monster. So it's this epic wrestling match, and Beowulf prevails and he tears the monster's arm off.
This is a book you've chose to teach in your class.
Yeah.
Why? Did you add it to the curriculum, or were you forced?
This is an inheritance.
Great question.
This is an inheritance from previous classes, but I did have the choice this year as I redesigned the curriculum to keep it or leave it, and I decided to keep it. So
Joe, start
this is
preparing
my choice.
Your response.
Yeah, don't mind. Mine's done.
This is my choice to do this. Yeah.
Book a lot? It feels like it could be just a lot. Do you know what I mean by that? Like,
yeah, I do. I do.
This is something that you couldn't read in a semester. Like, you'd want to take more time.
No. Dog. We get through this in like a month. Less. Yeah. We get through this in less than a month.
Who's we?
It's doable. It feels like a lot on the surface. I think so. You are reacting negatively to the names, and I think the names are. They put you off because, like, how do you pronounce Hrothgar? I mean, I just did, but you see it on the page and it's like, what is this? Like, that just sounds like a cough. That sounds like someone is coughing.
Do you ever read a book and the names are just, you don't even care to pronounce them? And so you just kind of make up new names for the rest of the
Absolutely.
Book? Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I name characters like Joe and Nick.
Like, in my head, if it was Hrothgar, I would just start calling him Rudy for the rest of the book. And then that would be Rudy.
There you go, Rudy.
So tell me about Rudy. So you think, okay, so surface level, it's a lot.
Yeah, the surface level is a lot. And I always like encourage my students whenever I've taught this, like, don't get hung up on, like, don't get freaked out by the fact that this is poetry. I actually have this conversation, like, it's okay. There's a cool story here. You have to read for the story. And then eventually you'll start to appreciate some of the more kind of abstract elements, like, say, the beauty of the language or the facility of the translation. But, like, at its base, this is the story of a guy who fights three monsters and defeats them all because he's so, so strong.
So when you read this, does it feel like poetry? I mean, I'd assume it's not written in rhyming verse, for example.
Well, so the translation I use does not rhyme. It is laid out on the page like poetry, but you can read it as a story. So, like, I might read, just opening up at random, this is the beginning of a feast, and this is what it would sound like in translation.
I don't believe this is random.
Totally random, guys. Oh, totally, look at this feast scene that I opened up to.
My eyes are closed. All right, read us your random passage, Ian.
The Geat was elated and gladly obeyed the old man's bidding. He sat on the bench, and soon all was restored, the same as before. Happiness came back, the hall was thronged, and a banquet set forth. Black night fell and covered them in darkness. Then the company rose for the old campaigner. The gray-haired prince was ready for bed. And a need for rest came over the brave shield-bearing Geat. He was a weary seafarer, far from home, so immediately a house guard guided him out, one whose office entailed looking after whatever a thane on the road in those days might need or require. It was noble courtesy.
Yeah, that's so easy to read, yeah.
It doesn't really sound. He uses, like, Seamus Heaney, who's the translator, uses, like, really kind of small words and very sort of language that is accessible. It's almost not quite like Hemingway, because sometimes he does this really kind of, he does use complicated words like depredations, but a lot of them are very short words, short sentences, kind of common folk speech. And the key thing is, it's not trying to rhyme. It's not trying to have this rhythm. It's not trying to do any kind of rhythm. It's just like, here it is. I think Haney realizes in translating this, it's a good story about a dude who is good at killing monsters. And he brings that forward.
And that's fine. Like, hey, if I'm looking for a monster book, you know what I want? Strong monster fights.
Yeah, you don't want like moral ambiguity.
Yeah,
like, is the monster actually a monster?
Lessons, or like getting something out of it that's deeper than smashing good. Yeah, I have
monsters.
Ian, I got a one-star review for you that I'd like you to review.
I'm sure you have so many one-star reviews.
All right, so this is our first, like, back to school series, right? So as I start to look up these books that you guys have selected, specifically the one-star reviews, I'm quickly realizing that this is just a bunch of high schoolers who were forced to read these books and have given it a one star because they hate their teachers. So, Ian, Ellen reads, here's her one star hater review. Another forced high school read. I'd rather drink a cup of thumbtacks than ever read that again. Thoughts?
I think she may not be clear on the relative liquidity of thumbtacks. I think that that's not really a viable drink. I think you could eat it with a spoon, but I really don't.
You're not understanding.
I think Ellen seems like a sharp kid. That's a pretty
sharp as a thumbtack.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty evocative use of language. Like, I love the image of drinking a cup of thumbtacks. It feels, if that's original, I think that's sharp.
Ian, why do you make your students read this horrible, horrible book?
Because I don't want them. Listen, if it's a choice between this book and thumbtacks, this book every day. Thumbtacks are going to damage your insides. Yeah, I would say a few reasons. First of all, I mentioned this a minute ago. These monsters are just so good. They're great monsters. Like, the monsters are amazing monsters.
Big monsters, strong muscles.
Unabashedly bad guys. Like,
is this good versus evil? You said it has religious undertones. It's gotta be good versus evil, right?
It is. It's good versus evil. Beowulf is the force of good, and the monsters, even when they have like good reason for being monstrous, they're still bad. Like, they're
Beowulf,
evil.
Is Beowulf a god?
This is a weird thing. So he has like,
because the movie, the trailer for the movie gave off real god vibes.
So, Nick, have you seen the movie or did you just watch the trailer like five
I
minutes
just
ago?
Watched the trailer, specifically the Angelina Jolie scenes in the trailer. Okay.
All right. I was talking with my wife about the movie this morning over breakfast, and mm-hmm. she said, I didn't like it. Angelina Jolie had stilettos on. I was like, yeah, that's a legitimate criticism.
Yeah, it seems like it was really sexist. Seems does like
Angelina
really...
Jolie, it just dawned on me, what role does Angelina Jolie play in this movie? Is she
Grendel's mother?
Shut up.
And she's like,
and she wears stilettos.
She's like, well, because her
like,
thing is
just go
is
watch
like,
the trailer. She's like naked in half of it. It's fucking bizarre.
She's not a danger in terms of like fighting and biting and killing. She's a danger in terms of seducing. So the class, I think that's actually kind of sexist in its own right. Like, let's see. We have to have a female character, Grendel's mother. And how does she endanger the men? She seduces them. Kind of. And actually, if you guys wouldn't mind, I'll just drop a little Hobbit fact in here. This whole thing where...
Oh, no.
Please.
This whole thing where like a person steals from a dragon and that makes the dragon angry inspired Tolkien's plot point in The Hobbit, where Bilbo steals from Smaug. Smaug finds out, and then he responds by going out and destroying Lake Town. So
that was inspired by this book?
Yeah. Tolkien got that. Tolkien loved Beowulf. Tolkien did a translation of Beowulf. He wrote this really influential essay on Beowulf. He was all in on Beowulf.
Okay. You're the original writer for Beowulf.
Beyonce, yes.
Yes, Beyonce.
Okay.
Time traveling Beyonce.
Beyonce? Beowulf? Oh my gosh. Beowulf, Beyonce.
Mm-hmm. It seemed a little on the nose. I just wanted to brush past it. But
I didn't realize it until you said it, Ian. Thank you.
I never met a joke I couldn't beat to death. Anyway, go ahead.
Brilliant. Am I misunderstanding? Are you saying there was an original writer who wrote maybe the first half and then they died and it was passed on?
No, scribe. There's an original scribe who wrote down the first half. If any of you have...
Yeah,
like,
but they... What? So somebody was talking and they wrote it down?
Maybe.
Well, probably copying it from an existing manuscript. Like a fake manuscript is always how I imagine it.
Maybe copying from an existing manuscript, or maybe this is a story that they were being told. Maybe someone was like an old storyteller was sitting in the monastery or the office, wherever this was made, telling this story, and the guy is writing it down. So I want to differentiate here between scribe and creator. The scribe is just the one who copies it down. The creation, when we're talking about oral tradition like this, the game of telephone, the creator is oftentimes a long, long way before. And the creator of this created this whole thing. Over the years, things got added, things got subtracted, and then we end up with these scribes in the around the year 1000 who write it down. But they did not create it. They were not the ones who came up with this.
How much do you think this was composed? So if you tell me the story of Beowulf, where like there's this monster that's eating people and Beowulf wrestles him into submission and tears off his arm and Beowulf is defeated, Grendel is defeated. That feels self-contained. And it almost feels like they're sitting around the fire the next night and someone tells the bard and someone's like, tell us more about the story of Beowulf. And he's like, what do you mean more? Like, they tore off his arm. It's above the fire. Yeah. So they're like, no, we want to hear more. And he's like, well, that night his mother appeared.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that it could kind of read that way, like episodic. I think the final version that we have, Beowulf does grow. So he starts off kind of arrogant and cocky, and then by the end of the book, he's just this kind of like sacrificial dude who realizes I have to go fight these monsters even if it kills me, because it's more important that I protect my people than that I get glory. So he's like, I might not get any glory, I might die, but I'm gonna fight this dragon because it's destroying my people. So I want to talk before I wrap up about language, if you guys are okay with that. And I thought I would start by reading some of the Old English, just so you can kind of hear how it sounds and be thankful that it's so translated. This is the Old English, and I want you to think about what you can understand. This is what I ask my students to do. I say, what in this can you understand? And there is a part at the very end, bear with me, that you can't understand. White. We gardene in gerdagum theod kuninga thrim gefrunon, hu tha ethelingus elen fremedon, thara imsitindra, ofer hrunrade, hiran schulde, gomban gildan, that wes good kuning.
What just happened?
So, Ian, I think I've got three of the last four.
Yeah.
I think at the very end, he said that was good.
Yes. The last four words are, that was good kuning. That was a good king, or that was one good king. And so kuning is king. And the crazy thing, I love doing this little section because people get so lost and frankly kind of annoyed in this. But you get to that last little sentence and they're like, oh, crap, I know what those words are, sort of, kind of. And it's this weird kind of familiarity.
I'm sorry, is that the book?
What I read was the original Old English. So if you look back at digital facsimiles of that burned manuscript that was thrown out the window, you will see the stuff that I just read. Now, most people today can't read that. And so most people who teach Beowulf,
most people on this podcast can't read that.
to be honest, my Old English is very rusty and I mispronounced many of those words.
Well, we all noticed, and how humiliating for you, Ian.
I didn't want to say anything. Yeah. Well, all right. So, I mean, you did deliver, Ian. You brought a monster book.
There are monsters. Yep.
Fucking A. Joe. Are there monsters in your book?
There are, but before I talk about them, can we take a bathroom break?
Let's do it.
Yeah, hell yeah.
All right, here we go.
All right, see you guys in a few.
Hey, Ian, what do you want to talk about next week on our back to school month?
Well, 2020 has felt really good and amazing, and I'm trying to imagine what the world would be like if it was worse than it is. What if the world were bad for a change? So I think I want to do dystopias.
So you're saying everything is going so well.
Yeah.
Let's try to imagine kind of a future where, I don't know, things aren't so perfect.
Right. Things are bad a little bit.
Somebody's been able to imagine a future like that?
Well, it's hard and there aren't many, but I do think that we could probably scrounge a few up. Really obscure type books.
Cool. Do you have any in mind?
I think I'm going to do Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. This has recently been turned into a TV show on the Peacock streaming service.
Yes,
and we've watched subscribed. Some of it, and it's thoroughly mediocre. And so the book is better, and I'm going to talk about the book.
And you have the premium Peacock streaming service, right? The 4K resolution?
Obviously. I bought that well in advance because I couldn't wait to get
on
the
pre-order. It. Joe, what are you going to read?
If we're doing dystopia, I'm bringing 1984 by George Orwell, written in 1948, the mother of all dystopias.
Cool. Okay, well, we're going to talk about those next week then.
Just to kind of like bring us down, because everyone's so just great.
Everybody's really happy, so I'm glad. I'm excited to hear about these.
All right, Joe. Brought a big dog here, didn't you?
Yeah, this is
let me just point out that Beowulf is not super long. I mean, it's pretty short.
Yeah, how many lines is it? You said early.
My copy has about 100 pages of Beowulf poetry.
Wow. Oh, that's super short.
Yes.
Yeah,
see?
No, it's
I told
I think
you
Beowulf
readable.
Is pretty short.
Yeah.
Well, short doesn't necessarily mean readable, but yeah,
that's true.
Your point to stake.
Great point.
Yeah, if it sounds like any of that stuff that he was saying earlier, it's definitely not readable.
Oh, yeah,
by definition.
Readable. That was good, Kinney.
Wait, what if, Nick, what if when somebody wins an episode, you say, that was good book.
All right, Borat. Joe, tell me about your 100-page book.
So my book is not 100 pages. My book's about four times longer than Ian's. It comes in at about 12,000 lines. The copy that I teach is about 400 pages long. But it's 400 action-packed pages in which Odysseus, our hero, the titular hero, the man the Odyssey is named after, in which he returns home to Ithaca after winning the Trojan War.
Ithaca, New York?
Yes, Ithaca, New York. He sails through the Aegean Sea into the Mediterranean, into the Atlantic, and eventually.
So he was an immigrant.
Does he get up to the Finger Lakes area? That's my question.
Beautiful this time of year. Beautiful.
He doesn't. He's mostly concerned with getting just home to Ithaca.
Did you guys know Cornell is in Ithaca, New York?
I did.
Did he found Cornell?
I'm very smart.
Did Odysseus found Cornell?
Yeah.
I think Cornell founded Cornell.
Oh, that makes sense.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because yeah. if it was the college that Odysseus it's founded, would probably be called like Odysseus.
How do we want to talk about the Odyssey? Because like it's everyone knows this.
I think we should talk about it in Greek. I think
in ancient Greek.
Right. To be respectful to this piece of literature, we need to talk about it in Greek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just
Spanakopita, that's all I got.
Good.
That's more than I have.
Drachma.
What?
How many drachmas?
Musica.
Okay.
Olympics.
Let's go.
Odysseus. So Ian's book is pretty old. My book's way older than that. Ian's book is written in 975, 1025 AD, so about 1,000 years ago.
Written down. Composed before that, but yes.
My book is written by Homer, and Homer is as Ian said early on, Homer is a blind poet. You would even call him maybe a bard. He composed the Odyssey. He maybe collected the Odyssey, but unlike Ian's book, my book has an author, and that author is attributed as Homer. And one of the things that I always like about this is not only was he writing this in 750 BC, but the events of the Odyssey are written in or are set around 1250 BC. So he's actually telling a story about a time that happened 500 years before he was alive speaking this poem. So this is something that
you know he's going to be accurate on those details.
Oh, super accurate. So it's like we tell a story about the Renaissance. Right, it's like we're telling a story about something set in the 16th century.
Go ahead, Joe. We're ready.
That was a Homer joke.
That was good.
I was gonna make that joke. Dang it!
Yeah, cross it off the list. Homer would have delivered this through certainly in verse. He probably would have done this with an instrument in his hands, like he would have kind of plucked along to it on a lute or a lyre. I actually don't know the difference between a lute and a lyre. I mix them up in crossword clues all the time.
Happens to the best of us, Joe.
Yep.
What you find in like a treasure chest. Liars are people who don't tell the truth.
Gotcha. That's a really good mechanism to remember the difference.
Right. Is it a bag of gold or is it a chronic deceiver?
So that is a really good mnemonic, but I still don't know how to attach it to either what a lute or a lyre is.
Well, you can just remember the full definitions, and then that will be a good way to...
They're both stringed instruments, so...
A lute looks like a little baby guitar.
It does.
A lyre looks like a...
a full adult man.
A lyre is more like a little harp. The Odyssey contains dozens of dangers and monsters, including a cyclops that just eats men whole. Like when he finds men in his cave, he just eats them.
Like one bite?
Like maybe two bites. Yep. He just throws them in his mouth and chomps them down.
Did they get into which end they start with? Does he go for the head first or feet first?
They don't get into it. I think they say he does it in one bite. In one, and that's just like you might a potato chip.
Gotcha.
Chapter 22 in the Odyssey is titled Slaughter in the Hall.
Cool. Next fact.
Yeah, I thought you would like that.
Just walk us through the chapters there.
Yep.
Read all the chapters. How do you describe this book? Because it is quite epic, right? Are these, yeah. Is this a series of short stories or situational things that happen? It's an adventure book, right?
Yeah, it's definitely an adventure book. It is a series of situations. It's a little bit episodic, but all of those episodes are in pursuit of this larger goal. And the larger goal in this book, the central tension of this book, the thing that drives the plot forward, is Odysseus trying to return home to his wife and now grown son. When he left Ithaca, his son was just a baby, just a little baby. His son Telemachus was a little baby. But now he went to fight the Trojan War, the famous war in which the Greeks seized the city of Troy, the impenetrable walls of the city of Troy. Odysseus not only was in the Trojan War, he was one of the heroes of the Trojan War. He wasn't known like Achilles, sorry.
Is this plot basically Interstellar?
I don't know. How does Interstellar go?
I'm not going to describe Interstellar on this podcast.
Hey, Nick, walk us through the plot of it. I've actually got a different Christopher Nolan movie to compare it to. So
we got to pick one.
Yeah, Inception. As I think about this book, as I recall, Joe, it kind of starts like it doesn't start with Odysseus leaving the Trojan War. It starts kind of like in the middle of things, and we have like his adventures. We don't like walk through them from the beginning to the end. We kind of get them in like flashbacks and embedded stories. We get like now he's sitting over here and he's telling this king about the dangers he encountered over there. So it really feels kind of like nested, and it feels weirdly like cinematic as I think about it, where you've got this kind of like present day plot of Telemachus and the suitors and the queen. And then you've got these layers as we kind of cut deeper into the story. That's where we get to Odysseus's cool monster fighting adventures.
Yeah, so that's exactly how it starts. It starts in the middle of things. It starts in medias res, and Odysseus is still trying to get home when we first meet him on this island. He's stranded on this island with this goddess. And this goddess, she wants to keep Odysseus there. She loves Odysseus. She wants to take him for a husband, is what the translation that I have says. And she essentially traps him in paradise. And Odysseus spends his days. It's the worst when you get trapped in paradise by a sex goddess. She's a sex goddess, by the way.
Happens to the best of us.
And he spends his days, instead of living it up in paradise, he spends his days sitting on the beach, looking off into the horizon, weeping because he cannot be home with his wife and child. And because his 20-year journey to get home has been, it seems, finally thwarted by this goddess Calypso.
Yeah. Hey, I got a question for you, Joe.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a book that has been and will be forever riffed on.
Okay. Like,
and stolen from, and, you know, satired and all this stuff, correct?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
Are those things stronger than the book itself? is this like a good book, or is this just something that is so iconic and so like ingrained in life that you have to like read it and respect it? But is it actually good?
So my honest opinion, My behind the curtain opinion is
that would be nice.
Yep. There are sections of the Odyssey. There are pieces of the Odyssey. There are full books of the Odyssey out of the 24 books that comprise it that are outstanding and absolutely worth reading and really riveting and fun to read. There's also large parts of the Odyssey in which, and people I work with are going to roast me for this, in which very little happens. Right? Like there's large parts of the Odyssey, which you can skip over, and depending on the year that we teach it and depending on what else is going on in the curriculum and testing and things like that, there are sections of the Odyssey that we as teachers get together and just skip over or summarize for students because we say like, hey, in these four chapters, Odysseus gets back to Ithaca and then like pretends that he's not there. like he basically like hides out for these four chapters.
You can summarize them pretty easily.
Yeah, you can summarize it.
Ian, aren't you working on like a Shakespeare edition right now where you literally like the every chapter has references to like pop culture.
Yeah, to performances of the plays. I think it's really useful to have some kind of reference. I don't know if I've seen editions of the Odyssey that say like, oh, this moment is riffed on in like this movie and this video game, but I think that'd be super cool. Either like as an edition of the book or as like a curriculum that says, okay, we're gonna look at this chapter and then we're gonna look at like five different adaptations of it across various media. Cause that would like
there's no way this isn't a podcast, right? That must already exist.
I don't think I want to start that podcast.
It certainly could be. I mean, Nick, I know we talked about the Odyssey briefly when we talked about Ulysses, which is definitely a podcast that is published, definitely in one of our episodes that is out. And I talked about at that time how you know the Odyssey without ever having read the Odyssey because you have seen it riffed on, you have seen it homaged so many times in your life.
Homaged.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if that's a word.
The word has entered the lexicon, the popular lexicon. Like when we talk about, you know, someone has a difficult journey back to the top or whatever, we would say like it was kind of an odyssey for him. And we don't mean that as a literary reference. We mean that as just like a word we would use, which is
absolutely
a demonstration.
Is that not a word? Is that literally in reference to this book?
Yeah,
of course. Yeah. The main character is Odysseus. It's called the Odyssey because of his name, like this guy who wanders, this guy who journeys. And you could go your entire life saying the word Odyssey and never once connect it to the fact that there's a book that comes from.
When you say it was an Odyssey, you are saying it was a journey of the length similar to that, length and difficulty similar to that, which Odysseus had in Homer's poem. Like you are comparing it to Homer's poem.
Guys, there are a ton of podcasts that do this. NPR has one. Joe, tell us about the Odyssey. Convince me to read this book because...
Yeah, so all of the awesome parts of the Odyssey have to do with Odysseus overcoming monsters, or sometimes overcoming like men or minor gods or things like that. But for this episode, I want to talk about just the monsters, because the monsters...
Are there any monsters that are unique to this book? Like, did he invent monsters? Did he invent a cyclops? Did that exist before the Odyssey?
Oh, God.
Hard to say.
Great question.
Yeah, I don't.
I'm gonna say
I'm gonna go ahead and say no. I'm while Ian looks it up, I'm gonna confidently
okay,
say
so.
No.
While Ian checks sources and actual research, Joe will just cross a line in the sand and say no.
Nope, he did not do that. That definitely existed in the popular imagination before then. But the monsters that he overcomes, I think, are interesting because each one of them has kind of its own superpower. So you're probably familiar, Nick, with the sirens, with the idea of sirens, these women that sing and they lure sailors to their certain doom.
Little Mermaid.
Sure, Little Mermaid. Great example.
I don't think that's a great example.
I'll be making the great examples here, Ian. But so, they are half fish, correct?
They are, no.
It doesn't say that, does it? It doesn't say they're half fish.
It doesn't say they're not half fish.
And it doesn't say Beyonce isn't a time traveler. At one point, Odysseus lands on an island with its sorceress, is what we would call her now. She is this witch. She has a magic wand, and she turns men into pigs. She turns his crew into these, like, slobbering, mindless animals.
Oh, well, this isn't a metaphor.
So that's actually, I think the most interesting part about the monsters in this book is exactly what Nick's getting at here, which is so many of them. And I've chosen 1, 2, 3. I have 6 in front of me to talk about. Out of the 6 in front of me,
definitely gets all those.
One of them is male, right? And the male is the Cyclops, the guy who like is this brute with this massive strength. All of the other monsters in this book, Calypso, Circe, the Sirens, Scylla, Charybdis, they are all female. And as such, they entice the men. They entice his crew. They entice Odysseus. The danger that they pose to him is, in a lot of ways, kind of a feminine danger. So, Nick, when I say Circe turns men into slobbering pigs, like what makes you say that's a little on the nose?
Pigs have noses.
Yeah, pigs have noses. They have big oinkers.
They have snoots. Snoots.
Is this why we call sleazeball men pigs? You pig.
Possibly.
Can I tell you guys about Cyclops quick?
Yeah, let's hear about
Cyclops. I did a bunch of research.
It's changed
so a bunch in the last 4 minutes.
It sounds like either Homer or a slightly earlier poet named Hesiod came up with the Cyclops. The first, like they believe the first instance of the Cyclops is Hesiod. But since this was maybe written down at a certain point, but the story may be older, Homer could have come up with them. But the most interesting thing to me is that they think that the origin for this myth of the one-eyed Cyclops is that there are skulls of elephants which are found in coastal caves of Italy and Greece. And people found these skulls and they saw the nasal cavity where the trunk would go. And they said, that's an eye hole. It must be the huge skull of a monster with a single eye in the middle of its forehead, which is insane.
That's amazing. Ian, thank you for doing that research.
You're welcome.
I stand corrected.
Well, kind of. Maybe corrected, maybe not.
I sort of stand corrected. I think maybe the most telling of the female monsters is at one point there's a famous scene in which Odysseus is sailing in this very narrow strait. And in that strait, so there is a choice that he has to make. He has to sail between either Scylla, who is this monstrous six-headed female, like kind of sea monster who stands on the side of a cliff and snatches sailors as they come by, or Charybdis, which is literally a hole in the ocean that opens up and sucks men down in like this whirlpool, in this spiral. And Odysseus...
Only men?
Well, sailors. So yeah, only men.
Or sailors.
Sailors.
The female... The female
so
version.
Odysseus.
Nope.
That's the Latin root.
Sorry, I gotta just jump here. No, Nick, that's not correct.
So Odysseus has to make this choice between which of these he's going to sail close to. Is he going to sacrifice six of his men, which will surely happen if he sails close to Scylla? Or is he going to go towards Charybdis and possibly sacrifice his entire ship and his entire crew in this hole that opens up and sucks the sailors in?
Are these like moral stories? Like, yeah, and then he does the right thing, and that's why you should never steal.
I don't think these stories are moralistic, or at least they're certainly not moralistic by our standards today. They may be moralistic. They probably do portray these heroic characteristics as they would have stood in, you know, 1200 BCE or in Homer's time, 750 BCE. But by today's standards, Odysseus comes off as like kind of a jerk and kind of selfish.
Yep.
So
cool.
So when for example, when they land at Circe's Island, like we would kind of think the modern day hero would like go and confront this sorceress himself. But instead he sends his crew to take care of it, right? Like he's like, hey, go check out this island. I think it might be sort of dangerous. If you could go take care of that, that would be fantastic. And his crew goes out and they are all entrapped by Circe. They are turned into mindless pigs. And when Odysseus shows up, he shows up in essentially a farmyard. Like all of his men have been turned into animals. And it's only when he has no choice but to deal with the problem does he kind of man up or be the hero that we would expect and rescue his men from this sorceress.
There's no... Okay. Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
There's no way a high school kid is going to appreciate this book. True, false, true or false?
Okay. Let me just like throw a word in there that like gets, it's a stupid word, but it's applicable. Relatable. Like what in this book is going to resonate with a high schooler?
Can I expound on that just a little bit?
Please.
Yeah, please.
Joe, how is this book hashtag relatable?
People like to assign
Let's
Romeo
be
and Juliet because
Let's be
they
relevant
think,
here.
Right. Hashtags are all the rage. People like to assign Romeo and Juliet because they think, in high school, they're like, young love. And then but the idea is there is something which will young men and women will connect with. So like, what is it in?
Well, Joe only has one eye.
That's never come up on this podcast before, but I am a Cyclops. So I think that's a really tough question to answer, because I think the reason that, you know, we teach this freshman year, which is early to read the Odyssey.
Woof.
Yeah.
It's just like, listen, kids, literature is hard and sometimes boring.
Hey, do you hate everything about literature? No, let me make you hate it.
Yeah, let me set the tone for high school English, pal, right?
I'm not even going to read these one-star reviews. There are like 30,000 high schoolers who have taken the time to leave their reviews on goodreads.com, and they all are high schoolers. You could just tell. I mean, they're kids.
The question becomes, when do we have to read classics, or do we have to read classics? Why, or is there value in that, or is there something cultural that passes forward with us? I think the Odyssey is a really tough sell for high school students. And when you say what's relatable about this, outside of Odysseus does some kind of cool things sometimes, and there's cool stories about him like outsmarting or overpowering monsters, there's huge portions of the Odyssey that I just think like, man, why are we doing this to our kids, right? Is that story still appealing to us? Like when we see like one man who's better than you are, who's stronger than you are, who's more heroic than you are, taking on evils that you could never face, I feel like that's...
It's a superhero book.
Yeah, it's a superhero book. That is kind of what Odysseus is. And obviously there's a market for superheroes. Like we see that now.
Hey, I got a dumb question. Is Odysseus a Greek god? Is he supposed to be a Greek god in this?
No, he's
a dude, but he gets by with a ton of help from the gods.
He's like a warlock. Okay. He has a special bond to a particular deity. And this is one of the reasons I think actually this book is now I'm on your side
yep,
with this.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the reasons this book is worth doing reading is because like it kind of sets us up to see Odysseus as this hero, as this Beowulf type who can conquer anything in his path. But as the book develops, you kind of get this divine layer of perspective, and you realize that he's not really so much in control of his actions. He can make some choices here and there, but like a lot of the big stuff, he almost gets home at one point, and then he gets blown away or shipwrecked. Like all of the big plot points,
yeah,
kind of he gets kind of channeled into. And this is a place where this book differs from Beowulf. Beowulf, like, he keeps saying, oh, it's because of God's help, it's because of this. Beowulf is just strong. He's just a good fighter. He makes his own destiny. Whereas it feels like to some extent, the book, the Odyssey makes us think Odysseus is going to make his own destiny, but there's always the divines kind of shaping and twisting and fighting, and he's caught in the middle. It's a worldview. It's an idea that like we are not masters of our own fate.
Okay. Yeah. The gods are, yeah.
Like the gods are up there. Yeah. But it's really interesting because the book, like it pushes against this. So we've got Odysseus who, if anyone can make their own destiny, it should be him.
Right. And throughout the book, we always see like when Odysseus gets out of these tricky situations, very frequently it is through the aid of the gods that helps him.
So here's the thing. I've never read either of these books. I think I should want to read the Odyssey, but I don't. I don't know. It doesn't. I should want to read it. So congratulations, Ian. I like the I like a 100-page book about by nobody. I think that sounds great.
That's the best description of this book I could possibly offer. 100-page book by nobody.
Yeah, or somebody's.
A variety of people. Yes,
a variety of people. Are there any other books that have been written that are like this? That have been written by? Are there any other iconic books that have been written by an unknown?
Oh, I'm sure.
Great. All right. Well, congratulations.
nothing's coming to mind, but I think very, very definitely we could do an episode in the future that would be anonymous.
Yeah, anon. So Ian, congratulations. I do request that the final quote that you read is entirely in Old English. Gosh, <goodness.
laughs> Ian, how many nerdy languages do you know? Obviously the Hobbit languages, I'm sure.
Yep. Elvish, obviously. Klingon, surely.
Scottish.
I don't know Klingon.
You don't know Klingon yet.
That's true. Did you guys know on Duolingo, you could, for a while, maybe you can't anymore. This is a popular language learning app.
This is going.
Sponsored this week by Duolingo. You could, for a while, learn High Valyrian, which is one of the Game of Thrones languages.
What a money grab. What a fucking money grab.
Yep.
So if you've made it this far, congratulations. That's unbelievable. please, if you like our podcast, please go tell a friend and leave us a review and download our stuff and smash all sorts of subscribe buttons. That's very much appreciated. There's no better way for this podcast to grow than for you to tell somebody. So that's very appreciated. Also, if you ever want to submit a book or recommend a book that we should talk about on this show, you can go to our website at youdontknowlitpodcast.com and submit something there, either a theme or a book. Ian, read us off in Elvish, please.
So this is Beowulf's final battle. He has grown old. He is powerful. He is well respected. A dragon comes and wrecks his land. And so he goes to fight the dragon. And everyone says, Beowulf, you're old. Don't do it. And he's like, I have to. This is my thing. I kill monsters. So he has fought the dragon. And the dragon has bitten him with its poisonous jaws. His sword has broken. And this is where the fight ends. Beowulf lunged at the enemy lower down so that his decorated sword sank into its belly, and the flames grew weaker. Once again, the king gathered his strength and drew a stabbing knife he carried on his belt, sharpened for battle. He stuck it deep into the dragon's flank. Beowulf dealt it a deadly wound. They had killed the enemy. Courage quelled his life. That pair of kinsmen, partners in nobility, had destroyed the foe, so every man should act, be at hand when needed. But now, for the king, this would be the last of his many labors and triumphs in the world.
Spoilers.